It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. North Korea's latest rocket launch on Sunday is raising concerns in the United States and with its allies that Pyongyang is moving forward with its ballistic missile program. The North's apparent noncompliance with international obligations raising questions about the purpose of the mission, which Pyongyang says was to put a satellite in orbit. UN Security Council on Sunday vowed to adopt expeditiously a new Security Council resolution. UN sanctions banned Pyongyang from conducting nuclear tests or any launches using ballistic missile technology. Rescue workers in the city of Tainan, Taiwan, clawed through wreckage today again in hopes of finding more people trapped in a 17-story apartment building that collapsed from a powerful earthquake on Saturday. Liu Shusheng is the Deputy Secretary General of the Taiwan City Government.
We are entering into the most difficult period of a rescuing operation because as we find out that there could be around 100 people still missing in the crash site. So we have successfully rescued over 300 people out of that crash building.
At least 34 people died in Tainan, a city of 2 million people, many of whom were inside that apartment building, those who were killed. Somali security officials are saying the explosion last week aboard a jetliner that had to make an emergency landing in Mogadishu was caused by a bomb. Security footage at the airport shows two men, apparently one an employee of the airport, handing the laptop to the apparent suicide bomber. This is VOA News. As Libya Sunday struck the Libyan city of Derna, those were airstrikes hitting a medical facility in a populated area, killing at least four. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but unidentified warplanes have struck Islamist positions in the past. Derna has an Islamic State presence. And the Algerian parliament on Sunday overwhelmingly approved a package of constitutional reforms, including limited terms for the president and approval of a parliament in naming a prime minister. Germany's anti-Islamic organization Pegida held rallies in several European cities over the weekend, protesting against mass immigration and what it called the Islamization of Europe. UN Secretary General's Special Representative for International Migration, Peter Sutherland, says he's alarmed by the growing hostility and xenophobic sentiments in Europe.
The recreation of borders challenges the whole integration of the European Union. More particularly, it challenges the moral responsibility of states to help refugees, to provide asylum.
More than 1 million people, most of them fleeing Syria, have gone to European countries in 2015. Well, a new poll suggests that Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and real estate mogul Donald Trump are maintaining their large leads in the northeastern U.S. state of New Hampshire, which holds a crucial primary on Tuesday. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone is up there, where he says Sanders is trying to rebrand his opponent, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, as anything other than a progressive.
This has really become the focal point of the debate. And, you know, one of the reasons for that is that in both parties, the sort of fringes on either side get really involved in the primary and caucus vote. So in the Democratic Party, it's the sort of liberal left, the progressives, who are flocking to Bernie Sanders, especially young people. And some of my VOA colleagues have noted that again up here in New Hampshire, as we saw in Iowa. So Sanders seems to have a hold on them. Hillary Clinton is trying to regain some ground here. She trails in New Hampshire by a fair bit. They're hoping they can narrow the gap between now and Tuesday, primary day.
The New Hampshire election also is seen as crucial for several GOP candidates, especially those in the second tier who did not do well in Iowa. Well, the U.S. National Football League's annual championship game, known as the Super Bowl, played Sunday night in the U.S. state of California. Many people thought that game might go to the Carolina Panthers, but it ended up that the Denver Broncos won. Final score in the game, Denver 24, Carolina 10. Get more at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today's Monday, February 8th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. The African Union defends its decision not to send peacekeeping troops to Burundi.
Bear in mind that the African Union is not trying to force itself into Burundi. We still believe that the government has competence, has capacity to change the situation on the ground.
Erastus Muecha is the deputy chair of the African Union Commission. The United Nations is piloting a new approach to disarmament and demobilization in the Central African Republic. Ghana starts Africa's first high-tech interactive distance learning. And Uganda's Electoral Commission says it is ready for next week's presidential and parliamentary elections.
Our readiness is reflected in the recruitment of the polling officials and the training. Our readiness is reflected in the arrival of the ballot papers from the countries that were printing them.
Jotam Taramua is the spokesman for Uganda's Electoral Commission. And a new study says global mental illness is widespread, undercounted, and undertreated. Those stories plus Mark Oman's post and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The deputy chairman of the African Union Commission says the continental body did not abandon the people of Burundi, contrary to Burundi opposition claims that last week's AU summit in Addis Ababa dropped the ball on the Burundian crisis by its failure to send peacekeepers. The exiled leader of the opposition Front for Democracy in Burundi, known as Frudebo, accused the African Union and the international community of turning their backs on the people of Burundi while, he said, the people were being killed by the government of President Pierre Nkurunziza. But Deputy Chairman Erastus Muecha says the African leaders discussed Burundi in detail and decided to give the dialogue process a chance.
I don't know what you mean by what happened, because Burundi was indeed actually discussed, and Burundi made a case. The Peace and Security Council made a case. And, of course, Burundi indicated that they are making progress in all-inclusive talks. The peace and security is improving. And the member states decided then to give them the benefit of doubt. But the matter was not just left there, because the assembly then decided to set up a high-level delegation that will go on the ground and meet with Burundi. And so I would not say that the matter is totally thrown out of the table, but that consultations are going on. And bear in mind that the African Union is not trying to force itself into Burundi. We still believe that the government has competence, has capacity to change the situation on the ground. And we hope that the signals that they are getting from the international community about the concerns is impetus enough for Burundi to really make sure that peace and security returns, there is reconciliation, and that the country returns to normalcy.
I did speak with the opposition leader, Jean Minani, and he said his comment was that the African leaders abandoned the people of Burundi because most of the leaders are on the same wavelength as the government in Burundi. So you are saying the African Union did not abandon Burundi?
That's right. And I think he needs to read the communique coming out of the meeting to change, because I don't know where he got his information from. I had him over your program, but it must be that he's using perceptions and not what actually transpired at the meeting.
On South Sudan, is the African Union happy with the outcome of what's coming out of the summit? Are you happy with what is going on in South Sudan?
I think so, because first of all, there is movement on the ground that the protagonists are making headway in terms of coming together to start forming the government, which is a critical, really, make or break of the whole process. And if that happens, one then should start to see the rest of the implementation of the program of reforms in the security sector, political reforms, and moving forward to settle the refugees being in place. So I think, one, we have always regretted that it's taken too long. We also know that the people have suffered unnecessarily, but we cannot, of course, then run away that to say that, yes, there is progress, although the progress is not as fast as we would have liked to see.
Erastus Muecha is the deputy chairman of the African Union Commission. He was speaking with me from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. It's a little over a week before Uganda's February 18th presidential and parliamentary elections. The eight presidential candidates, including incumbent President Yoweri Museveni, who has been in power for 30 years, are scouring the country for votes. Meanwhile, there are claims by some opposition supporters that the election will not be free and fair, and by some government supporters that the opposition plans to rig the vote. But Jotin Taremua, spokesman for the Elections Commission, says his organization is working hard to deliver a free, fair, and transparent vote.
I can assure you that the commission is very ready for the 18th of February 2016 when we vote for president. And our readiness is reflected in our availability of the National Voters Register. Our readiness is reflected in the recruitment of the polling officials and the training. Our readiness is reflected in the arrival of the ballot papers from the countries that we are printing them.
There are some concerns raised by some people that the number of registered voters appears to be more than expected. Are you aware of that?
No, that is a baseless allegation, and it is a baseless fear.
This is a concern I think I may have read raised by presidential candidate, the former Prime Minister Mbabazi. He has alleged that rigging sometimes takes place at Election Commission computers in Kampala.
No, maybe whoever is making that allegation does not know how a voting process is conducted, because voting is done in the open, counting of results is done in the open, announcement of results is done in the open, then the declaration of results form is filled, signed by the presiding officer and the agent, and that form indicates the scores of different candidates. It is that very form that the returning officer of the district receives, and then he tallies together with other forms from other polling stations. So any fears of vote rigging by the Electoral Commission computers is unfounded, because what you put in the computer is what is on the form.
The chairman of the Electoral Commission made a comment, I think it was last week or so, saying that anyone who involves themselves in acts of violence or chaos amidst or after the elections will be prosecuted and jailed. There have been some who said, does the Election Commission have the powers to jail somebody?
No, that is not correct. He never made that statement. But yes, if you break the law, then the law will take its course. But he never said that whoever does that will be killed. He has never said it.
Some officials have made pronouncements alleging that the opposition is planning on rigging the election. Has this been brought to the commission's attention?
But sometimes we need to be saved from these baseless allegations. How do you know that there is a plan to rig elections when you can't cite any strategy that indicates that they are planning to rig elections? We cannot really spend a lot of time on responding to allegations of that nature without any basis. That is being unfair to us. There is no plan to rig elections.
So let me put the question the other way. Does the government have confidence in your commission to conduct a free and fair election?
I am hopeful that every other stakeholder in the election process, including the government, has confidence in our preparation for the freedom election, because whatever we do, they are aware, and we do it with them.
Jotem Taremua is the spokesman for Uganda's Elections Commission. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. Today's Monday, February 8th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Still to come, Michael Uman Sports in our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day. Daybreak Africa time. It's 14 minutes past the hour. The United Nations is trying a new approach to the disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration, or DDR, of armed groups. The new approach, described as pre-DDR, is being launched in the Central African Republic's northern town of Kaga Bandoro, where former combatants of the mainly Muslim Seleka armed group and the Christian and animist anti-Balaka movement are being paid to do community work. Viewers Nick Long reports from Kaga Bandoro.
Since November, the UN mission in Kaga Bandoro has enrolled 481 ex-combatants in pre-DDR and is paying most of them nearly $4 a day, mainly for cleaning up the town. To qualify, they had to hand in weapons, 206 locally made hunting rifles, 10 modern assault rifles, and 2,600 rounds of ammunition. Pre-DDR is a temporary arrangement pending the launch of a full-scale disarm, demobilize, and reintegrate program, which will have to be planned by the government. Unlike a conventional traditional DDR program, this deal does not involve giving each ex-combatant training for a particular occupation. But some of those in the program in Kagabandoro have already saved enough money to launch their own businesses, including shops and even an internet cafe. On Friday, the mission collected more arms from about 130 people. But UN weapons expert Helder Gaspar da Costa was not impressed with the haul.
How many people are you paying, sir?
15,000.
Da Costa asks one young man who's presented a locally made hunting rifle how much he paid for it. The man says he paid 15,000 Central African francs, about $25. Da Costa says that was expensive and questions whether there's any ammunition. When the young man says there's none, Da Costa says the gun is useless and probably a fake. About half of the dozens of hunting rifles handed in are listed as non-operational. Da Costa also questioned people as to whether they were real combatants. You are living in Boto and fighting on the Dago axis, he asks another man, claiming to be anti-Balaka. That's 48 kilometres. Then you are doing a marathon every day. Get real, he says. Da Costa says former combatants must bring in real weapons or they will not be accepted for pre-DDR. He challenges anti-Balaka supervisor Maxim Azudanga to produce genuine ex-combatants. Azudanga wanted the UN to accept the applicants who assembled on Friday. The UN should accept these weapons and enroll these people on the scheme, Azudanga tells VOA. Otherwise, they'll go back to banditry, he says. The United Nations is considering benefits for communities that hand in this type of weapon, Da Costa says. Benefits like solar panels for community use are being considered, but not pre-DDR payments for individuals. Nick Long for VOA News, Kagabandoro, Central African Republic.
The Ministry of Education in Ghana says almost 45% of that country's primary school teachers and 30% of junior high school teachers have not been formally trained. With the help of international donors, authorities in the African country have now launched a two-way interactive training program to help solve the problem. VOA's George Putish reports.
In many schools in rural Ghana, there are no computers, TVs or smartphones. So during recess, girls amuse themselves with games while boys play soccer. In class, teachers talk while students listen, trying to understand and remember. There's very little engagement and virtually no interaction because many teachers themselves were not trained to do it. The private non-profit Varki Foundation, together with co-donor Dubai Cares and the Ghanaian Ministry of Education, wants to change that. Varki CEO Vikas Poda spoke to VOA via Skype.
What we're trying to do is leapfrog what they should have received when they first became teachers to providing the latest and most cutting-edge classroom pedagogy that is available.
With the help of a $2 million grant from Dubai Cares, 40 schools have been equipped with a satellite dish, a solar-powered computer, a projector, and a modern electronic blackboard, as well as a trained instructor called a facilitator. During a two-hour interactive training session conducted every other week live from a TV studio in Accra, two instructional leaders, together with facilitators at the site, engage head teachers and deputy head teachers in two-way training. It is a trickle-down program in which head teachers pass the instructions to other teachers on how to teach the students.
The teachers then come back every 2 weeks into our classrooms, which have the satellite hubs, with the questions that have been raised by their teachers. And that peer-to-peer learning that happens is a fairly powerful way of improving your understanding and your skills base.
In 17 sessions, with 3 to 5 schools at a time, the instructional leaders will train approximately 5,000 teachers over a 2-year period. Educators say the students are already seeing benefits from their teachers' training.
They have gained interest more in going to school because now teaching has become interested. It has become actively based, unlike first when the teacher will rattle and then leave.
Students also say they are now enjoying classes.
The teachers will give you a marker to go to the board, and whatever will come into your mind, then you write it. So after the writing, you will see many funny things, so it makes us laugh.
The Varki Foundation says at the end of the pilot program, an independent agency will evaluate the outcome and suggest ways to improve the process. George Putic, VOA News, Washington.
The number of people living with mental illness worldwide is grossly underestimated, according to the authors of a new study. They say the true numbers are masked by other health problems. VOA's Jessica Bremer reports.
The global disease burden associated with mental illness is underestimated by more than a third. That's according to researchers at Harvard University and University College London, who say mental illness accounts for 32% of all disability worldwide. Previously, mental illness was thought to be responsible for 21% of global disability. The authors say people with other health problems, such as heart disease, pain syndromes, neurological problems, and HIV, often suffer from psychiatric disorders that go unrecognized by the medical profession. Clinical depression often goes along with chronic illness, but is rarely reported and treated, according to the authors. Daniel Vigo, a psychiatrist and fellow at Harvard School of Public Health in Boston, says psychiatric disorders exact a high human cost.
People with mental illness die up to 30 years before their peers. People with mental illness die before a heavy smoker, just to have a perspective on how serious this is.
Part of the problem, says Vigo, is the stigma that accompanies mental illness. People with psychiatric disorders are more likely to avoid doctors and treatment than people who are physically ill. He says the percentage of people who are being treated for mental disorders, about 8% of the U.S. population, is only the beginning. Vigo and colleagues are calling for greater recognition of the problem by the global community and for treatment for psychiatric conditions to be offered at the primary care level, where many people with other health problems are seen.
Mental health service needs to evolve and not be considered as a separate issue anymore. And there are a number of evidence-based interventions that are being piloted or applied at a larger scale in many both developed and developing countries that sort of show the way that this can be done.
Treatments that can be offered through primary care include both medication and therapy. But first, Vigo says it's important for countries to recognize a problem exists. In April, a mental health summit will take place in Washington in conjunction with the annual meeting of the World Bank. An article by Daniel Vigo and colleagues on the scope of the global mental health problem is published in the journal The Lancet Psychiatry. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa's Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. A brace scored by Meshack Elia and won by Jonathan Bolingi propelled the Democratic Republic of Congo to a convincing 3-0 victory over Mali in the Orange African Nations Championship final in Kigali, Rwanda on Sunday. Earlier on, Ivory Coast edged Guinea 2-1 to clinch the bronze medal. This is the second time the Congolese have lifted the trophy, having triumphed at the inaugural edition in Ivory Coast in 2009. Staying in Kigali, the Confederation of African Football first vice president Suketu Patel disclosed that CAF is backing Bahrain's Sheikh Salman bin Ibrahim Al Khalifa in the forthcoming FIFA presidential elections. It is now left to each of CAF's 54 national affiliates, the largest voting bloc in FIFA, to cast their secret ballot at the elections in Zurich, Switzerland on the 26th of February. Turning to athletics, Ethiopia's Aksumawit Embai posted the world's leading women's 1500-meter time this year of 4 minutes and 8.22 seconds when she triumphed at the IAAF World Indoor Tour meet in Karlsruhe, Germany on Saturday night. Kenyan Augustine Choge led Ethiopian Yomif Kejelcha and Kenya's Bethwel Birgen in a 1-2-3 African 3,000-meter sweep, while Kenya's Nicholas Kiplagat Kipkoech was third in 800 meters. On the infield, Jonathan Drack was second in a Mauritius national indoor triple jump record of 16.67 meters, while Frank Elembe was third in a Republic of Congo national shot put indoor record of 20.53 meters. Meanwhile, Abraham Kiptum and Ethiopia's Halima Hussein carried the day in the men's and women's event at the Access Bank Lagos International Marathon in Nigeria on Saturday. In rugby, Fiji beat South Africa 26-12 in the bronze medal playoff at the IRB 7 series in Sydney, Australia on Sunday. Argentina outplayed Kenya 24-0 in the final of the plate category. India beat Namibia by 197 runs in the quarterfinals at the ICC Under-19 Cricket World Cup in Fatula in Bangladesh on Saturday. Earlier on Friday, Zimbabwe dismissed Canada by 6 wickets in Cox's Bazar. Today, Monday, South Africa and Zimbabwe face off in the semifinals of the plate category. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 8th. On this day in 1986, figure skater Debbie Thomas became the first African-American to win the women's singles of the U.S. National Figure Skating Championship competition. She went on to win a bronze medal in the 1988 Winter Olympics in Calgary, Canada, before retiring from amateur figure skating. Also on this day in 1978, Leon Spinks defeated world heavyweight boxing champion Muhammad Ali. Ali regained the title on September 15 that same year and went on to become the first person to win the heavyweight boxing title 3 times. On this day in 1986, Oprah Gayle Winfrey became the first African-American woman to host a national television talk show, The Oprah Winfrey Show. It became the highest-rated talk show in history, reaching about 15 million viewers a day in the United States alone. On this day in 1894, the United States Congress repealed the Enforcement Act, thereby making it easier for states, especially southern states, to take away black voting rights. Originally passed in 1870, the act had established criminal penalties for interfering with a person's right to vote. But after its repeal, southern states passed a host of measures to block or limit the number of blacks who could vote. On this day in 1925, Marcus Mosiah Garvey, sometimes called the Black Moses, entered federal prison in Atlanta, Georgia, after being convicted of what many blacks felt were trumped-up mail fraud charges. Garvey had built the largest black mass movement in African-American history by emphasizing racial pride, economic empowerment, and the building of a black empire in Africa. And in African history, on this day in 1994, a cargo plane crashed in the Democratic Republic of Congo, killing at least several hundred people and wounding more than 500. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 8th. Congratulations to Edwin Uhara of Abuja, Nigeria, Jaden Siwale of Kitwe in Zambia, and Precious Garley of Senkor, Monrovia, Liberia. You are the winners of our February 5th question. Whose arrest sparked the Montgomery bus boycott? The answer, Rosa Parks. Now, here is our question for today, February 5th. Who was the first African-American to be named president of the Harvard Law Review? Once again, who was the first African-American to be named president of the Harvard Law Review? Send your answers to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address.
Stand up for your right. Get up.
And that's it for this Monday, February 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clarty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Marco Oman, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that you will make this week a very productive one.
Tuesday on Health Chat. Host Lenore Modou continues her discussions about Zika virus with her guest, Dr. Oluwatosi Omeli, Family and Community Medicine, Howard University Hospital. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We'll call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat is Tuesday at 1730 UTC right here on VOA Africa.